From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Snyder launches an effort to get Michigan to rev up our recycling efforts.
This recycling initiative of his is really the first step for us to better understand where it is we're at and what it is we need to do for the future.
Plus, why is a university enrolling athletes in classes that don't even meet?
There were hundreds of these classes over years, and hundreds of students were in them, and they were predominantly athletes, and many of them on the football and basketball team.
And with tax day finally here, how worried should you be about getting audited?
Only about 1% of all tax returns get audited.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. You know the saying, nothing is certain except death and taxes, and the latter is fast approaching. Tomorrow is April 15th, Tax Day. On today's Stateside, we'll look at the likelihood of your being audited and what you should know. I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour, colleges and universities care about giving their students good educations, but is there a double standard for student athletes? That question on today's show. But first, Governor Snyder rolled out a new statewide recycling plan today in hopes of increasing recycling in the state. Right now, Michigan recycles about 15% of all usable materials, and that's way below the national average of 35%. And Michigan is number 7 among the 8 Great Lakes states in its recycling performance. Just what are we losing out on by throwing out all that glass, plastic, metal, and paper? And what's the governor's plan to get us to recycle these materials? We're joined now by Kieran O'Brien, who's executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy. Glad to be here.
Why is Michigan such a laggard in recycling?
It's been probably 20, 25 years of really a lack of leadership and initiative and funding to help communities meet, you know, the needs of residents to provide those services to them.
There's been other things on the front burner, in a sense, for our...
Most definitely. And, you know, the recession of 2008, I think, caused us further damage in that area. But we're looking ahead now because we've identified the value of recycling to Michigan's economy and environment. And really, it's a win-win situation for all of us. So we've got many great recycling programs throughout the state. We just need people to participate in them fully. But we also need to increase access to recycling programs. There are still many people in Michigan that are not served by good recycling opportunities, and making sure that we all have access to those opportunities will pull more materials out of households and make them ready commodities to be used as raw materials in manufacturing. And that's what we aim to do with this program.
And it must be good news, I must say, for anyone who cares about recycling to know that Kevin Orr in Detroit is actually, when he contracted out that garbage collection to a private firm, it's the first curbside recycling for Detroit starting on May 5th.
We're very pleased with that. Detroit is the largest city in the country that doesn't have a comprehensive recycling program. And so in spite of the challenges Detroit is facing right now, the reason why it's a priority for Kevin Orr and his team is that it does have so much potential for creating jobs and, I think, building community in a way that maybe other programs don't have. So recycling has many, many benefits, and we're just beginning to see what those are. The governor's proposal, it's a shot in the arm for recycling. It's going to help us begin what we know needs to happen, and that is really education at all levels, education of consumers, education of businesses, education of communities, and technical assistance to help them provide, you know, these services that maybe they're not providing. The important things that needs to happen is, you know, even though we have a good guess that we're recycling about 15% of our resources, we don't know for sure what our recycling rate is. And we need to dive down into the numbers to find out exactly what we are recycling in terms of types of materials and where those materials are concentrated. We also, conversely, need to better understand what materials we're not getting. And where our infrastructure needs to be boosted to really provide comprehensive collection and processing opportunities across the state.
So how much of what Governor Snyder is unveiling today with this statewide recycling plan fits those challenges?
I think it's a very kind of practical, measured approach to doing something positive because we don't have the information we need in Michigan to know where investments are going to make the most sense. So with the measurement effort that is a key part of his initiative, we'll begin to delve into those numbers, and it will help us identify particular places where investment of funding or investment in particular policymaking or in public-private partnerships, you know, what kind of investments will get us furthest the quickest. One of the most exciting parts of his proposal is really this Governor's Recycling Council, because that is a recognition to me that this is only the first step. And then over the next 5 years, we are going to be looking at what kind of policies we can employ, what kind of market development tools we'll need to develop, what kind of education it's really going to take us from this 15% recycling rate to a 50% recycling rate. Because if we can get to 50% recycling, it means an additional, you know, $435 million into the economy that was previously just going to the landfill.
Karen, what needs to happen in Michigan to improve the infrastructure? And I notice one of the parts of the governor's plan is to help provide convenient access to services. So what needs to grow and develop in terms of the recycling infrastructure?
You know, that's the part that we struggle with because intuitively we know, those in the industry know, that there have been, you know, significant private investments in recycling in Michigan. But what we don't know is where communities have been left behind, and if they've been left behind because there isn't the processing capacity in their region. So part of this measurement effort will be to kind of assess what the capacity is and identify where there's holes in that capacity. But certainly in rural communities, it's difficult to provide cost-effective services. But, you know, if you think about it, 98% of the population does have their waste picked up from the curb. And we think, you know, having your recyclables picked up at the curb is a valued service as well. The fact that we can take those recyclables and process them into a commodity, that makes money for us and helps offset the cost of providing those services. Whereas if we're just picking up waste from the curb, it costs us money to dispose of that, and it costs our society into perpetuity because we're managing and monitoring those landfills, you know, for forever, really. So there's an ultimate service that is being provided by having that curbside collection opportunity. And we think that in order to really move people and businesses to participate in recycling, we need to provide convenient access to recycling opportunities, as convenient as we can.
I'm speaking with Karen O'Brien, who's Executive Director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition, as we take a look at Governor Snyder's new plan to hopefully boost, double our recycling efforts in 2 years. It's a 15-point plan. I noticed that he is looking at some incentives for communities and for business.
Certainly, you know, we don't believe that anybody does anything by being shamed into it. We want to help communities and businesses see that they have a lot to gain economically and environmentally from taking these important steps. And these steps do take an investment and commitment to, you know, doing business in a different way. You know, you can't just put your garbage at the curb anymore and forget about it. You got to think a little bit about, you know, what is this, you know, material that I'm putting in, you know, which bin should it go in,
right?
The recycling bin or the waste bin? So we're asking people, we're asking businesses, we're asking communities to think a little bit differently. So it's going to take a significant effort to, you know, move to a different paradigm of materials management. And if we can get there, there's significant benefits along the way.
Let's talk for a moment, if we can, Karen, about businesses. And the reason I say this is we got an interesting email from one of our stateside listeners, Lynn, who goes to a gymnasium, a chain gym, and she started noticing water bottles. And she checked and found out they don't recycle those bottles. And she kind of did some digging, figure 100 bottles from the gym. And she actually crunched numbers up, say this particular owner owned 10 gyms in Michigan. There's 36 of them in Michigan. And then across the U.S., there's over 800 of these gyms. And she figured at 100 bottles, 800 gyms, 350 days, that's 28 million bottles going to landfills in the United States. And that's just one popular chain of clubs, of workout clubs. What is it that it takes to get business more involved?
You've just mentioned some really significant numbers of materials, and communities in general provide recycling services to their residents as part of a public service, and it really is to keep waste from piling up places. Small businesses incur the costs of managing these materials or having these contracts, and if we can make it easy for them to do so, they will provide those services. Large businesses, corporations in Michigan, are benefiting very highly from recycling. Hayworth, facility manager at Hayworth, is actually the chair of our board of directors. They actually make $1 million a year, each year, from their recycling efforts. So, when all of the costs of waste and materials management are said and done, they are making $1 million. So there are definitely economies of scale at work here, and communities can help to build those economies of scale for small business and residents.
Kieran O'Brien is the executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. Thanks for speaking with us today, Kieran.
Oh, my pleasure, Cindy. Thank you.
What happens at the intersection of college athletics and college academics? To what degree are student athletes allowed to get by with a lighter academic load, enabling them to play those games that are such moneymakers for the school and the NCAA? Well, more and more these questions are being asked, often to the great discomfort of those who run colleges and universities and their athletic programs. To talk about the student-athlete double standard, we welcome Paul Barrett of Bloomberg Businessweek. His recent piece is entitled, In Fake Classes Scandal, UNC Fails Its Athletes and Whistleblower. Paul Barrett, so good to have you with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
And we're happy to welcome author, college teacher, hockey coach John U. Bacon. His latest book is Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, John.
Thank you.
Well, Paul, your piece for Bloomberg is a real eye-opener. It centers on UNC and a woman named Mary Willingham, which you describe as a secret enabler of NCAA, Inc., something she now deeply regrets. So tell us about Mary and what she was doing with the student-athletes at UNC.
Mary was an academic counselor, the sort of low-profile figure who exists on every single Division I campus around the country. Without these individuals who are coaching, cajoling, keeping track of the athlete's academic life, such as it is, many of the top athletes, particularly in basketball and football, would simply not stay eligible according to the NCAA's own rules. And that's why I call her secret enabler. The dozen or so such figures on every Division I campus are absolutely crucial to keeping the multi-billion dollar business of college sports going. And then the question is what rules do they follow? And do they behave in an ethical manner? And Mary Cunningham at UNC, one of our great public universities, said that for many years there was a lot of corruption there that was keeping some of their top athletes in football and basketball eligible. The worst form of it was the steering of athletes into fake classes.
Fake classes that weren't really even meeting.
That's right. These were supposed to be lecture courses, but in fact, they never met, and the student did not interact with a professor, with any professor. And at the end of the term, the student would cobble together a single-term paper. God knows how. Mary told me that they were often just plagiarized from the internet, and then they'd end up with an A or a B. And this was going on, there were hundreds of these classes over years, and hundreds of students were in them, and they were predominantly athletes, and many of them on the football and basketball team.
And what did the data show as far as the kinds of majors and classes? You certainly were able to see that there was quite a pattern to the kinds of classes and majors that these student-athletes were taking.
The out-and-out fake courses were offered by the African-American Studies Department at UNC, which was one popular major among members of the football and basketball team. But as happens on many of these campuses, a lot of the top scholarship athletes end up kind of clustering in certain departments that are known for offering, if not fraudulent classes, that's kind of the extreme, then at least very, very easy classes where there's not going to be much demanded of them. And flipping it around, where they're not going to be given an education that's going to be worth very much after they get done with their sports careers. And, of course, most of these athletes, their college sports experience is the end of the line. Most of them are not going to become wealthy professional athletes. At UNC, the majors where the athletes tend to show up in had to do with basically sort of sports sciences, you know, a major devoted to training people to be sports coaches, and also in communications.
Communications, that umbrella major. And for
right.
Mary Willingham, clearly became bothered spiritually. It really could, I can tell from your story, it tore at her what was happening, and she became a whistleblower. What became of her on the UNC campus?
Well, as far as the top administration was concerned, she's become a pariah, and they've done everything they can, short of out and out firing her, to ostracize her. They demoted her, they gave her a new office in the basement of a building, and they have publicly questioned her veracity and her credibility in what I consider to be a very underhanded campaign of character assassination. UNC is the pride of the North Carolina university system, the Chapel Hill campus. It is a place with great academic tradition and with a, you know, fanatical sports following. The UNC Tar Heel men's basketball team has been national champions repeatedly, as recently as 2005 and 2009, and there's huge loyalty to the team. And as a result, she's absorbed a lot of flack from UNC alums and other loyalists. And I think it's not deserved. She was part of a corrupt system for a number of years, and then she realized, I just can't do this anymore. Even though everyone wants me to do it, I can't. And she stopped. She eventually came forward. She spoke to the local newspaper, the News and Observer, which has done a terrific job at digging out this scandal. And now Mary exists in kind of a limbo. She's still technically employed. She's filed a grievance about her demotion. And she's a hero in the eyes of sports reform activists. But we'll have to see what happens to her in the long run.
John Bacon, how much of what you're hearing about what was happening with Mary at UNC is a surprise to you?
Well, part of it, but not all of it, of course. And as Paul will attest, that this is not... The scale of this is unusual. The utter shamelessness is unusual. I mean, not actually meeting for classes, hundreds of classes. The reporting that Paul did was fantastic, so kudos on that. The overall theme of it, not that unusual. And what's not unusual at all, sadly, is when someone finally got the guts to speak up, they're the ones who get hammered. As Paul said, there's almost always a low-level academic advisor without a PhD, certainly without tenure. And they get dumped on quite severely. And the NCAA will go after these people. They never, ever go after the coaches. The coaches are millionaires. They've got millionaire lawyers, et cetera. They don't go after the schools themselves, usually. And one of the saddest parts of this story, from my point of view, is the NCAA, having looked into this, decided that because other students, not just football and basketball players, were taking these classes, therefore it's not an athletic issue. It is an academic issue and therefore not their domain.
So the hand-washing.
Unbelievable. And that's crazy. And that's to say that, okay, if not all the guys in a class are drug dealers, then the whole class should not be, you know, how does that make any sense? It makes no sense at all to me.
Do you think the problem is more about the time demands that are amping up through the years on these young athletes? Or is it more that these young athletes are coming out of high school and being recruited without the academic chops to cut it in college?
The answer is yes.
To both. Okay.
Look, I mean, the NCAA claims that you spend 20 hours a week on your sports. To come up with that fraudulent number, when the Michigan hockey team goes to Fairbanks, Alaska, to play a weekend hockey tournament. 108 hours total they spent on this. This is from my previous book.
Mm-hmm.
I think about 8 or 9 count as actual NCAA hours. So almost 100 of those hours don't count as being away from campus or away from your studies. So it's an absurd system. That's one thing on their part. Second of all, look, the schools can't fix what the public schools are giving them in some cases. What you do need, in my opinion, my theory is, mm-hmm. you need a viable minor leagues, as you have in baseball and hockey, that if you don't want to be a student, you're not qualified to be a student, you want to get paid, there's a place to go. The real problem is this is the only path to the NBA or the NFL. So you're going to get misfits. When you have misfits, they're going to find ways to make you fit.
Paul, what do we hear from the athletes themselves? And by that, I'm wondering, for example, does a kid who may be one and done really want to be spending time doing math homework or writing a history research paper when, frankly, he wants to be on the basketball court getting ready for the NBA? I'm not saying this is not short-sighted, but where are the athletes about this?
Well, I think, you make a good point. I think many of the very top-flight athletes, the ones who have a realistic shot at getting drafted into the NFL or the NBA, to some of them, this is probably all just irrelevant, kind of a distraction. But the question is, is it really acceptable for an esteemed university to be complicit in letting that young man or woman, in the case of women basketball players,
mm-hmm.
Use the university just as a vehicle for trying out for professional sports, and really, is it in that young person's long-term interest? I mean, asking an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old, would you prefer to do your math homework or just get ready to become a millionaire next year? Of course we know what a lot of young people are going to answer, but the
Certainly.
School is purporting to be an institution of higher learning, and the degree is supposed to be meaningful, and the fact is that a terrific college football player who gets into the NFL, the chances are his career is only going to last 2 or 3 or the outside 4 years, even if he's successful before he gets injured. And then if he is without a meaningful degree, and a lot of these guys have degrees, but they're empty degrees, they're fraudulent degrees. And when they come to the end of their career, and they may be very banged up if they're football players, and they've really learned nothing, and they can, read only at a junior high school level, I think later in their life they're going to realize they signed up for a bad deal.
If you've just joined us, that was Paul Barrett of Bloomberg Businessweek, who dug into a fake classes scandal at UNC and how it's failing its athletes, and the whistleblower who enlightened everyone to this. And we're also speaking with John U. Bacon and, of course, his book, Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. I'd like to kind of talk about the climate for universities and for colleges. Here in Michigan, we have seen the state funding drop drastically through the Great Recession. We've got a climate where you have Republican state lawmakers, for example, considering yanking $500 million in funding from Michigan State University as punishment for teaching a labor class that allegedly promotes unionization. So is it any surprise that schools are going to try to squeeze every dollar they can out of athletics?
Yeah, no doubt about it. Right now, that the whole university system is under such duress that even when you get aside from the whole athletic part of the equation, we are creating what I would call a donor culture, where because the state of Michigan only provides 4% of the budget of the University of Michigan outside the hospital, you have to get 96% somewhere else. If that's the case, then it's going to be grants. It's going to be research, of course. It's going to be any gift you can get, really. And donors tend to have expectations.
And meantime, the money coming in for the TV games and selling Wolverine merchandise.
It's that, but it's also the showcasing of the university. Mm-hmm. And the football games and the basketball games are where the gift bids are often made. I'm not saying the whole thing's corrupt. That's not my point.
Yes.
The point is that it provides a stage for everyone to feel happy about it, to meet with the big mm-hmm. donors in the president's box, and this is where the asks are often made. Now, having said all this, I must qualify this. I do teach at Michigan and at Northwestern. I get paid peanuts in both cases. This is not if it's a conflict of interest, it's a very small one.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my last two books have been utterly objective and have been received as such. But I will say this, that at Michigan, the basketball team you just saw in the NCAA tournament, those guys are sincere students. They're good young men. I've had them in my class, and they do an excellent job. So it's not everybody doing this, but it's too many. And when John Beilein, the Michigan coach, knows about North Carolina's situation, he's saying, the guys who follow the rules feel like fools. Now, you do it anyway, but you feel foolish.
What do you think about that? What are your thoughts, Paul?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's very important to stress that that the majority of Division I athletes, you know, who are in college are going to classes, and many of them are doing just fine. At UNC, for example, half of the varsity athletes across all sports are on the dean's list. Another 25% are doing okay academically. And at UNC, we're really talking about a universe of about 150 at the outside, maybe 200 academically at-risk athletes. But they are disproportionately members of the men's football and basketball team. And so that's an important thing. Second thing is, I don't think anyone urging reform wants to rob Michigan, UNC, or any other school of the pageantry and the fun and the competition of the Saturday on the football field or the Monday night in the basketball arena or so forth. Of course, you can have all of that school spirit and you can have all of that fun and competition and without it being a multi-billion-dollar industry. That's not a necessary part of it. College sports have gotten more and more amped up over time, because of a couple of very distinct factors. Television, the advent of ESPN in the early 1980s, turning college sports into much more of a big business. And then there's the endorsements, Nike et al., and the merchandise, and so forth. It has not always been quite this amped up. And, as we said at the outset, this arrangement of having a $16 billion a year industry situated within our institutions of higher learning is a unique arrangement to the United States.
Oh, yes.
There's sports all over the world. There's higher education all over the world. No one combines the two the way the United States has come to combine the two. And I think one good question to ask is the one that was asked earlier, which is, if you need developmental leagues for football and basketball, why not have them separated out and called what they are, which is, minor league teams, and let the people who play football at school, be student football players.
And, of course, now with, for example, what's happening at Northwestern, you've got the National Labor Relations Board accepting the football players' petition to hold a unionization election. And, Paul, you point out in your story for Bloomberg, whenever that subject of pay for athletes comes up, the NCAA says, hey, they're getting a degree, they're getting a scholarship.
Yeah, well, that's true. And there's a contract out there. There's an implicit deal. You give us your services on the field of sport, and you get in exchange a degree. And in many cases, a degree that is subsidized with a scholarship. Terrific. If the degree is meaningful, that deal might make sense. But if the degree is empty, well, then actually the athlete is being cheated, whether or not the athlete himself is willing to go along with it. I'll grant you that many of these young people are willing to go along with it, but that's why we don't let 18- or 19-year-olds, completely decide exactly what they want to do while they're in college. They're still, the responsibility of the university, and the university needs to have a sense of integrity.
I'm curious, just overall response to your story, Paul, because I'm just wondering if those fans that are flocking to the big house in Ann Arbor for a Saturday afternoon in the sun, do they really care?
Well, we've had reaction to this story has been as powerful as the response to almost anything I've ever written in 30 years in journalism in terms of volume and in terms of the degree of passion. And it's really, run the gamut. There have been some very disappointing, to me, responses from people who have a kind of, my university, love it or leave it kind of attitude, going all the way to very fanciful conspiracy notions about how I'm just carrying water for NC State, UNC's bitter in-state rival, all kinds of just crazy and in some cases venomous stuff. I mean, one guy was joking online about collecting my personal information, and another guy said, no, you don't need that. I've just got a rope, and all we need to do is find a good tree.
Oh, well, nice.
Yeah, very nice stuff, particularly coming from the South, where that imagery is a little more pungent than it is in other regions in the country.
Yes.
But on the other hand, there's been very, very gratifying response from educators from around the country, from some current and former faculty members at UNC, and just more broadly. So this subject, there are very few subjects that get tens of millions of people revved up instantly. and college sports, for better or worse, is one of those subjects.
Paul Barrett with Bloomberg Businessweek and John Eubacon. Thanks so much for speaking with us. I know we could sit here for an hour and talk about this. Fascinating to talk to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And it is here, well, almost here, tax day, tomorrow, April 15th. Procrastinators are waiting till that proverbial 11th hour to mail in that check that you owe Uncle Sam. Others may be already opening the envelopes and spending your refund checks. But lurking in the back of many minds is a nagging question. Will I get audited? In all actuality, our likelihood of being audited is pretty low, about 1 in 100, but the odds go up as your income goes up. Let's find out how to decrease your chances of being audited and the do's and don'ts if the IRS decides to take a friendly, closer look at your tax return. We're joined now by the finance editor for the Detroit News, Brian O'Connor. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Well, first of all, let's tackle this story of the IRS scam that's been making a lot of headlines, and it's been racking up victims. So exactly what's happening?
Yeah, this is really something. The IRS first warned about this in November, and since then it's become the biggest tax fraud to hit in their history. It's over $1 million now. And it's kind of an oddly low-tech, very suspicious kind of scam, but it seems to be effective. Basically, somebody calls you up pretending to be from the IRS, saying that you owe back taxes, and they have to be paid immediately, or you might be arrested or deported or lose your business license or your driver's license.
And they're actually tossing out parts of people's Social Security numbers at times, too, aren't they?
At some times, yes. The caller ID is spoofed to look like the IRS 800 number. They may know the last four digits of your social, which, of course, let's face it, we use that for
everything,
all kinds of stuff,
yeah,
that they may have gotten online. And then they will sometimes follow up with another spoofed call from, say, a local police agency or your state DMV, and may even send you a bogus-looking email with an IRS logo as a follow-up. And the thing that really ought to set off everybody's suspicions is the fact that they're asking you to pay immediately either by a wire transfer or a prepaid debit card.
Mm-mm-mm.
And that's where your question mark ought to go off, that this is not a valid kind of thing. The IRS generally contacts you by mail. They're going to send you an actual explanation of why you've been a bad tax boy or tax girl. And if you can't pay, the IRS is pretty much about the nicest loan shark in town, because they have really good payment plans. In some cases, almost anyone who owes back taxes is eligible for certain types of plans, and the interest rates are extremely low.
So no one's going to be phoning you up, getting rough over the phone, making threats,
right,
any of that, and it will be a snail mail contact that you're going to get.
Nine times out of ten. You know, okay. Let's face it, we all know that if the IRS really wants something, they send jackbooted thugs to drop from black helicopters and crash through your roof and steal the silverware you inherited from grandma. If you've really done something that criminally heinous, the IRS is not going to call first. They're just going to show up with the Treasury agents.
All right. So let's say I get one of those letters from the IRS, Brian, that suggests that maybe I've been a bad tax boy or a bad tax girl. Should I call an accountant or a tax attorney?
Well, it depends, and which is, of course, the answer to every question in personal finances. It depends. Generally, you're going to get that letter probably about 2 years after you filed. And what happens is only about 1% of all tax returns get audited. And you might not even know that you're being audited, because about 70% of those are just the IRS sending you a letter asking for some follow-up documentation or some kind of explanation about something. So it's not a guy in a black suit showing up on your doorstep with a, you know, Treasury badge.
So it's a correspondence audit.
Right. It's a correspondence audit, and that is the bulk of them. And if you need to gather paperwork, you can write back and request for an extension for about 2 weeks. And that's generally how these things are resolved. In fact, you get another kind of audit that you don't really know about, which is sometimes that the IRS just looks at what it's received in your tax return, and it adjusts your refund.
Aha.
Because the IRS says, oh, well, look, this person got an interest payment, and the bank notified us, but they forgot to claim it.
So they'll just fix it.
So right there, the IRS just says, well, you know, let's just apply it. They recalculate your taxes. They lower your refund, and that's it. And technically, you know, you've been audited, but you don't even know it. And, you'll, of course, you'll get an explanation, a specific letter from the IRS that talks about that. The rest of the time, you'll get a correspondence letter. You may go back and forth, but they'll generally say, okay, well, we've decided you owe this, and here's the interest and penalty. And then, again, if you want to dispute it, then you can ask for a hearing. You can hire a professional if you want. Or if you need to pay what you agree to pay it and you don't have the money, then you can approach the IRS about a payment plan.
Well, now give us a sense, Brian O'Connor, what are some of the red flags for those folks who are kind of the procrastinators starting to fill out their returns right now? What are the red flags that could attract some unwanted attention from the IRS?
Well, part of that is it's a pretty mysterious thing. The IRS actually scores tax returns. And then depending on the score, that's going to trigger an audit. Only about 2% of all that 1% of audits are supposed to be just random, where they just, you know, the computer throws a dart and says, okay, we hit
lucky you,
Cynthia, and we're gonna do a we're gonna challenge some of her stuff. Usually it's something specific that they want to challenge, and it's going to be something that's out of character. Side businesses tend to be, you know, freelance or a big unreimbursed professional expenses and things like that are, you know, typically those are the places where people are going to get creative.
Yeah.
And maybe claiming things that they're really not entitled to. So on the other hand, I've been claiming freelance income for, you know, more than a dozen years, and I've never even gotten an audit letter.
I would suspect making too much money too quickly or taking really large charitable donations is waving a red flag in front of them.
You know, is it charitable deductions that you can document? You know, if the bulk of them are cash things to, you know, you wrote a check to a registered charity and that kind of thing, then it's not going to be too suspicious. But if you suddenly, you know, you're claiming you donated a $5,000 Picasso print to Goodwill, that's going to come up because they're going to say, okay, do you have, you know, do you have the appraisal? Do you have the documentation?
Sure, sure. And I guess one more very important do is don't show up with that proverbial shoebox and a jumble of receipts and miscellaneous documents. Try to get yourself organized.
Right. And, you know, the other thing is that a lot of the stuff that's really sketchy is the stuff, of course, that they've gotten stricter about. So, for instance, there are a lot of rules about charitable donations of items now. They want a receipt. They want a picture. They want an appraisal for anything over a certain type of amount. They want documentation on certain types of things like artwork or appraised shares of stock and things like that. But on the home office thing, they've actually gotten a little cooler, and they're going to, I think, restrict a lot of people's creativity because they're basically making that just as a flat amount per square foot.
Well, food for thought for the procrastinators who are just getting their returns together, or if you're one of the early birds, it's not too early to start planning for next year's tax return. Brian O'Connor, Detroit News Finance Editor, thank you so much for talking with us. Always good to get together with you.
And thanks for having me.
It's quite a long line to draw from a writer's studio in Michigan in 2014 to the west coast of America during World War II. That's where over 110,000 people of Japanese ancestry were ordered by the U.S. government to walk away from their lives and report to internment camps. This dark chapter in our history ultimately resulted in more than $1.6 billion in reparations being paid to those Japanese Americans who'd been interned or to their heirs. Matt Faulkner describes himself as an author and illustrator for kids. This Michigan writer's new graphic novel tells the story of the internment camp through the eyes of a teenager named Koji Miyamoto. Koji's father is Japanese, his mother is white. The title of this graphic novel is Gaijin. Matt Faulkner, so good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Ms. Canty.
Well, this title, Gaijin, is very important to understand the very tough position that you've put Koji in. Explain what that word means.
Gaijin in the 1940s was a derogatory term. It was a racial epithet that was not nice. And when I talk about Gaijin to people who were around at that time, mm-hmm. their very put off by it. But it's interesting, the definition has changed over the past 60, 70 years so that now it's more – it just if you go to Japan, you will just naturally be called gaijin.
Because you're an outsider?
Yeah, you're an outsider. Okay. And that's what it means, outsider. It literally means outside person.
Mm.
But it's still – you know, there are people who still believe that it has – it's a real slander. It's not nice to be called that.
So what you show us in your graphic novel is how being half white in the internment camp is just as tough as being half Japanese in San Francisco during World War II.
Yeah. I will talk with indignation as a human being to see that they put sick people, pregnant women, elderly, babies – two-thirds of the 110,000 people put in these camps were children under the age of 14.
Huh.
Okay? At the same time, my mother was a child during that time. My uncle was a Marine pilot who fought over Okinawa in a Corsair while his great-aunt, Adeline, was in the camp.
And that's what I want to get to, because one might wonder why a Michigan children's author and illustrator wants to tell this story of a boy in an internment camp, but it really happened in your family. Your great aunt, Adeline Conlon, Irish American, married a man named Ichiro while she was on tour in Japan in the 1920s.
Yeah, she was a vaudeville singer and very successful. Mm. And she had gotten invited to travel to the Orient, as they called it back then.
They did, yeah.
And she made her way to Tokyo, met Ichiro there, and he was part of an industrial family, well to do. And we have one picture of her. They got married, of her pregnant with her daughter, Mary. But during the 20s, anti-Western sentiments started to grow as the fascist government started to get in power in Japan. And there started to be some tension between her and Ichiro. And then there was a massive earthquake during the mid-1920s.
Yeah.
60,000 people died. All of these things together, she said, I want to go back to the States for a little while and then I'll come back. She went, I guess, in the late 20s, brought Mary with her and lived with my great-grandmother mm-hmm, and my great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. Eventually, she was not accepted there either. Her mother and father, her father, my great-grandfather, kicked her out.
And this is before the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This was the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
She had married outside of her religion and her race. Her daughter was a half-breed, mm-hmm. you know, Mary.
Yeah.
They eventually moved in with my grandmother, my mother's mother, mm-hmm. who was disabled. And she took care of them for a little while, but it was too much. And she had to go to she decided to go to California. Mary grew up. And she already had two kids by the time – I think she was 19 years old by the time Pearl Harbor happened.
Hmm.
She was pregnant with a third. And when they shipped Mary and her mother and her two babies, she gave birth at Manzanar internment camp.
Right.
She gave birth 2 weeks after she arrived in one of the tar paper shacks.
So, and life in the Manzanar camp for Adeline and her children inform what you've put into your graphic novel, Gaijin, and what happens to Koji and his mother. And I think for anyone who has not looked in more deeply to this, you really make it very clear that this was not going away to camp. This was very unpleasant. They'd walked away from their lives. There was a lot of things that you show us that happened in the camp that should not have happened to these people. It's interesting. You've attracted some major backing for this graphic novel. As we say, George Takei wrote a review of the book, and it was also published by Disney. So that's some interesting attention for an artist from Southeast Michigan doing this story. Is it because of the nature, do you think, of the story?
First of all, I'm going to just let you know that Mr. Takei let me know that his name rhymes with I'm so gay.
Thank you, Mr. Takei.
Yeah.
He's a fun presence on Facebook. I'll just tell you that. Everybody passes George Takei.
What a dear man.
Yeah,
I got
the pleasure
of working with him. I just sent him one of these promo pieces that Disney put together. It's just the first 12 pages mm-hmm. of the book, and he jumped on it, and he got right back to me. His partner, his spouse, Brad, emailed me back and said, "Yeah, we'd like to help. We're gonna." And he sent a. He's very busy. He's become extremely popular. Mm-hmm. In addition to all of the Star Trek stuff,
right?
Then I said to him, "You've been so kind. Would you mind doing a voiceover for a brief animation that'll advertise the book?" And he said, "Sure. Just get a studio, and I'll go in there and do it." He's the sweetest guy.
Was he surprised that this guy from Michigan was trying to tell the story of the Japanese American internees, or was he just glad somebody was trying to get it out there?
I think he's just glad that more people are willing to talk mm-hmm. about it right now. Mm-hmm. There is some. It gets a little like, why is a white Irish Catholic dude mm-hmm. Interested in this?
Taking this on. Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, I wrote another children's book called A Taste of Colored Water that's about a water fountain that had the word colored over it.
Yeah.
And kids thought it was fruit-flavored water. And people didn't, why are you telling that story?
Why is it important for you to share difficult stories like this?
I don't like bullies. When I was a child, we can get out the violins, but everybody has bully issues, right? Everybody has experienced it one time or another. And to me, the idea that a person can feel better by allowing themselves to think that someone else is less than them, that's their process for themselves feeling better, is really part of is a disease. And something that no disease can be done away with by hiding it. We have to keep on putting it on the table, and especially for children. Children are more than happy to talk about this stuff. They want to. What's been fascinating to me has been the grown-ups who get fidgety in their chairs when we start talking about this stuff. And also the people who come up to me afterwards in schools and libraries who quietly want to share with me their experience of a colored water fountain, or how their aunt or their cousin mm-hmm. Was in California during World War II and their neighbor got put in a camp, and how sad that, these stories. And people are still quiet about it, and there's trepidation about it. And I just find that, when that is the issue, we need to talk. We got to put it out there on the coffee table and say, hey, this is something we're going to talk about.
Well, a fascinating, fascinating book. And you can learn more about Gaijin and also Matt Faulkner's work. Go to the website, GaijinAmericanPrisonerOfWar.com. GaijinAmericanPrisonerOfWar.com. And it's spelled GAIJIN. Matt, pleasure to meet you. And thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.